Good morning to you all. And this morning we're going to be back in the book of Nehemiah after a couple of weeks break from this series. And if you remember, our study of the book has been based around the theme of building for God. And as we've studied this theme, we've seen through the example of, through the example of Nehemiah and his people, that there are various elements involved in seeking to build God's kingdom, both for the Jews who were rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem and for us. And we started by seeing Nehemiah grieved by the news of how the walls of the once great city of Jerusalem still lay in ruins, even many years after the first group of exiles had returned. And we are encouraged by Nehemiah's example to start with prayer. We then saw how, having prayed and sought God, he went with a vision to the king to ask to be released from service in order to go and accomplish the task of rebuilding the walls. And he drew up a plan of what he would need in order to be able to do this. Having been granted permission by the king, and with the gracious hand of God upon him, Nehemiah then went to undertake his own on-site survey before he went to speak to and to mobilize the people to collaboratively help turn his vision into reality. And that was a reality that would take effort, both collective and personal. And then a couple of weeks ago now, we saw just how, when things seemed to be going really well and the walls were starting to take shape, that various forms of opposition sprung up. And so that the Jewish people had to arm themselves and really stand alongside each other day and night in order to counter the threats made towards them. And so we come to today's passage, which is from Nehemiah 5. And Jonathan is going to come to read it for us now. It's on page 489 of your church Bibles, if you're looking to follow it in that.
Now the men and their wives raised a great outcry against their Jewish brothers. Some were saying, "We and our sons and daughters are numerous. In order for us to eat and stay alive, we must get grain." Others were saying, "We are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our homes to get grain during the famine." Still others were saying, "We have had to borrow money to pay the king's tax on our fields and vineyards. Although we are of the same flesh and blood as our countrymen, and though our sons are as good as our men, as good as theirs, yet we have to subject our sons and daughters to slavery. Some of our daughters have already been enslaved, but we are powerless, because our fields and our vineyards belong to others." When I heard their outcry and these charges, I was very angry. I pondered them in my mind and then accused the nobles and officials. I told them, "You are exacting usury from your own countrymen." So I called together a large meeting to deal with them and said, "As far as possible, we have brought back our Jewish brothers who were sold to the Gentiles. Now you are selling your brothers, only for them to be sold back to us." They kept quiet because they could find nothing to say. So I continued, "What you are doing is not right. Shouldn't you walk in the fear of our God to avoid the reproach of our Gentile enemies? I and my brothers and my men are also lending the people money and grain. But let the exacting of usury stop. Give back to them immediately their fields, vineyards, olive groves, and houses, and also the usury you are charging them, the hundredth part of the money, grain, new wine, and oil." "We will give it back," they said, "and we will not demand anything more from them. We will do as you say." Then I summoned the priests and made the nobles and officials take an oath to do what they had promised. I also shook out the folds of my robe and said, "In this way, may God shake out of his house and possessions of every man who does not keep this promise. so may such a man be shaken out and emptied. At this, the whole assembly said, Amen, and praised the Lord. And the people did as they had promised. Moreover, from the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, until his 32nd year, 12 years, neither I nor my brothers ate the food allotted to the governor. But the earlier governors, those who preceded me, placed a heavy burden on the people and took 40 shekels of silver from them, in addition to food and wine. Their assistants also lorded it over the people. But out of reverence for God, I did not act like that. Instead, I devoted myself to the work on this wall. All my men were assembled there for the work. We did not acquire any land. Furthermore, 150 Jews and officials ate at my table, as well as those who came to us from the surrounding nations. Each day, one ox, six choice sheep, and some poultry were prepared for me, and every 10 days, abundant supply of wine of all kinds. In spite of all this, I never demanded the food allotted to the governor, because the demands were heavy on these people. Remember me with favor, O my God, for all I have done for these people.
Thank you, Jonathan, on what is a long passage. Thank you, well read. So we've listened to the reading, but before we get stuck into the text, I'd like you to listen to something else, just a short piece of music. So, are you sitting comfortably? Recognize that? What was it? Absolutely. The chilling signature music from the film Jaws, released in 1975. And many of us who are just about old enough to remember the film may remember it's a pretty uncomfortable watch. And the music is certainly pretty uncomfortable to listen to, too. It's difficult to hear without feeling rather on edge. And a few years later, in 1978, just as American coastal tourism was recovering, Jaws 2 came out. Now, if you can stretch your mind back that far, I wonder if anyone can remember what the strapline for the advertising campaign for Jaws 2 was. Well, yeah, absolutely. Just when you thought it was safe to get back in the water. I don't know if, like me, you've experienced this just when you thought it was safe phenomenon. You've come perhaps through a testing time at work or in your personal life, and things seem to be getting back on track and going well again. But just at that point, problems which seem to have been disappeared for a while crop up again and throw a spanner in the works. For Nehemiah too, there must have been an element of this just when you thought it was safe idea. With the Jews having been mobilized collectively and effectively in chapter 3, and with the rebuilding of the wall going well, the threat from Tobiah, Sanballat and others had cropped up in chapter 4. And Nehemiah had had to organize the people to counter this threat of violence. But as we left chapter 4, it seemed that the external threat had in fact been countered and things were starting to look safe and that the rebuilding work could perhaps again move ahead. But now, as we heard at the start of the reading in chapter 5, internal problems strike. And these are issues that have probably been brewing for some time, actually. They're not necessarily... I love a bit of audience response. It's brilliant, isn't it? Let's hope we're not all doing that by the end. They aren't necessarily problems that have come about as a result of rebuilding the walls, but problems that have surfaced in the context of what the people are doing and which need to be addressed and acted upon before things can move ahead. Did you feel uncomfortable as you heard that Jaws music a minute or two ago? Because I felt somewhat uncomfortable preparing this sermon because it's been a real challenge to me. And in some ways, I hope that none of us here this morning actually feels comfortable as we hear what God has to say to us. Some of us here may be blessed with a relatively comfortable position in life. And if that's true for you, I believe that's a blessing. There's no need to feel guilty about that. But Nehemiah, when we meet him, is in a relatively comfortable position as cupbearer to the king, a man who's trusted and well looked after. But although comfortable in position, Nehemiah is not comfortable in heart. He's distraught at the plight of his people and the holy city of Jerusalem, and so he's moved to act to join God in his mission. God stirs us up. And so this morning, as we listen in our small groups, as we meet during the week, in our own personal quiet times, let's ask ourselves, are we ready to follow Nehemiah's example and to step outside of our comfort zones, outside of our security, and to join God in what he is building? In particular, today we're going to look at the theme of justice. The title is Kingdom Building Acts for Justice. We love, we serve, and we follow a God of justice. But what does he require of us? Micah 6, verse 8, both asks and answers that question. What does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. Now, this verse sums up the teaching of Nehemiah 5 quite well, and my prayer for myself and for all of us is that it also sums up how we seek to live our lives on a daily basis. So let's look in more detail at the chapter now. We're going to split it into three sections, and as we do so, we'll aim to explore both the original context and the application for us. Verses 1 to 5 of the text describe the outcry. Verses 6 to 13a tell of the response. And verses 13b to 19 show us the example. And within this three-part structure, as Nehemiah steps in to act for justice, we'll see three general principles at work which apply to him in the context of this passage, and I believe also to us as we seek to build God's kingdom. If we are to act for justice and respond to what the Lord calls us to do, we need to hear it, we need to feel it, and we need to do it. So what was the outcry against injustice that Nehemiah was faced with here at the start of chapter 5? Well, it seems that rebuilding the walls of the holy city of Jerusalem, building God's kingdom, so to speak, was not really proving to be a blessing for the Jewish people. Not only was there the hard physical effort and the long hours of work and the threat of external attack, but some other hardships cropped up that they were facing and were now also coming to the fore. Firstly, there was a problem of food. Verse 3 tells us there was a famine, and with large families to feed, this was proving to be a struggle. The workers were having to mortgage their land and their homes in order to be able to buy food. Second, there was a problem of finance. As a conquered nation, the Jews had to pay taxes to the Persian king. And some of the group were having to borrow money in order to be able to meet these financial demands. And then thirdly, for some, there was a serious impact for them in terms of family. In order to meet their financial commitments, some had been forced to sell their children into slavery, even giving them over as slaves to wealthier, more powerful men from among their own nation. Exploitation of several kinds, it seems, was rife. An outcry against hardship and injustice, food, finance, family. Let's just pause there a minute. Are we reading the book of Nehemiah, or are we reading our daily newspapers or listening to the 10 o'clock news? Are we reading and are we listening? Because if we are, there's some pretty uncomfortable information out there for us to hear. Food. Do we hear that about 30 million people are on the brink of starvation in Yemen, Nigeria, South Sudan, Somalia, and other parts of East Africa? Do we hear that in the UK in 2016 and 2017 alone, Food Bank distributed over 1 million emergency supplies of food? Finance. Do we hear that developing countries have had to pay $4.2 trillion in aid, in interest on debt payments since 1980, which is far more than they have received in aid over the same period? And do we hear that according to recent statistics, there are 3.9 million people in persistent poverty in the UK here today? Family, do we hear that there are an estimated 20 million people in slavery worldwide, including 5 million children? Do we hear that the number of people reported as potential victims of slavery and human trafficking in the UK alone has more than doubled in the past 3 years? Do we hear it? Or is it because that these great outcries have been going on for a while, or because they don't seem to affect us personally sometimes, that we have become just a bit deaf to them? Or in the face of such overwhelming problems, do we sometimes feel powerless and so turn our ears elsewhere? Have we even, like the Jewish nobles who were exploiting their own people, hardened our hearts and put our earplugs in so that the outcry doesn't even register? What about the issues, problems, and injustice within our own families or within our own fellowship? Are we alert? Do we take time and make space to listen? Nehemiah listened, and Nehemiah heard. Do we? So that was the outcry. Nehemiah was ready to listen, and he heard it. Let's look now at how he felt about it and how he responded to it. Well, verse 6 tells us that when he heard of the injustice and the exploitation that was going on, he was very angry. We're often conditioned to avoid anger, aren't we? But Nehemiah was far from the only godly man to respond to an unacceptable situation in this way. We only have to think of Jesus and the way that he responded to the money changers who had turned the house of prayer into a den of robbers. He certainly wasted no time in displaying his righteous anger. Nehemiah, too, was rightly angry, but despite his anger, he didn't shoot his mouth off straight away without some serious reflection. Verse 7 tells us that he first of all pondered the charges in his mind. The text doesn't say as much, but knowing that he was a man of prayer, it's highly likely that he brought the situation before God in prayer before deciding how to respond. Then, having done so, he didn't try to dodge the issue. First of all, he confronted the nobles and the officials who were the primary culprits, it seems, in charging interest to their own people. That's what it said, exacting usury, charging interest, because this was a practice explicitly prohibited by Jewish law. It's mentioned in Exodus 22:25. He then called for community action. In verses 8 and 9, he called all the people together. in a public meeting, challenging them as to their behavior and the example that this was giving to their enemies around them. Clearly, he felt that their behavior was both a poor witness to God and a dangerous display of disunity. Verse 10 is an interesting one to look at too. In it, Nehemiah recognizes that he also has a responsibility to ensure that his conduct is exemplary. He doesn't just point the finger at others, but humbly recognizes that he may need to change his behavior too. In verse 11, he proposes a solution, namely the restitution of anything that's been misappropriated and the repayment of the interest that's been being charged. And finally, in verse 12, Nehemiah calls the people to covenant, to commit to keeping their promise to make things good. As their leader, Nehemiah felt the anger of the injustice being enacted and responded prayerfully, positively, and purposefully. But what about the nobles and the officials who are being accused? How did they feel in the face of the charges that were being brought against them and that Nehemiah had confronted them with? What was their response? Well, firstly, they were prepared to recognize their wrongdoing. Verse 8 tells us that they didn't try to argue back or defend themselves, but they simply kept quiet because they could find nothing to say. They knew they were guilty as charged. Following Nehemiah's proposal, they then responded positively and promised reparation and obedience, as we see in verse 12. And this was the start not only of a practical resolution to the situation, but also a collective spiritual awakening. Finally, we see that out of this situation of injustice and exploitation, the ultimate outcome was one of praise for God. With the internal division healed, the whole assembly was able to come together in praise to the one they were all seeking to serve. So that was how Nehemiah and the people responded. But what about us? What's our response? Well, this is where it starts getting particularly challenging and uncomfortable for me. And I wonder how it is for you. Let me take you back to 1982. For some of you, 1982 seems just like the twinkle of an eye, a blink of an eye away, or perhaps you weren't even a twinkle in your father's eye in 1982 for some of our young people. But come back with me to 1982 and the Spring Harvest Conference, Tony Campolo speaking in the big top. I was there aged 7. And I can still remember it, one of the most powerful and shocking statements that I've ever heard used in a sermon. It made an impression on a well-brought-up middle-class 7-year-old boy, and it continues to shake me now, 35 years later, as a 42-year-old man. It shakes me because it cuts to the core of my beliefs, my attitudes, and my lifestyle. It may shake you too. And I'd like to warn you in advance that it contains a swear word. Tony Campolo used it deliberately because it's essential to his point and to his challenge. If it offends you, please forgive me. But if it impacts you, then thank him. Here's what he said. While you were sleeping last night, 45,000 children died of starvation and malnutrition. And what's worse is that you don't give a shit. And what's worse still is that you're more concerned that I said shit than that 45,000 children died last night. And that's what's wrong with our Christianity. We've taken our Christian faith, which calls us to be passionate about the poor and the oppressed and to sacrifice everything that we have to heal the suffering of others, and we've twisted it to a morality that tells us that we shouldn't use four-letter words. The Christ of Scripture is not so much concerned with the four-letter words that we use as he is with those who are dying and who are in need. How do you feel about that? How do you respond? With shock? With outrage? With anger? With a rather large gulp? If I'm honest, even 35 years on, I feel some of all of those, but actually, above all, I actually feel a bit sick in the depth of my belly, because I think he's hit a nerve and he's challenged me with something I need to respond to. As I listen again to those words and as I read Nehemiah 5, I'm challenged to recognize my association with some of the ills in our society. I'm called to examine my priorities, my attitudes, my consumer choices, my behavior. I'm challenged to ask myself if I truly walk each day in the fear of God and reflect how that walk might serve as a witness to those around me. I'm challenged to ask myself whether I truly am a Jesus follower or just a moralizer. And I recognize that I need to confess rather than to point a finger. And where God confronts me with something that needs to be put right and offers me a chance to respond, just like Nehemiah did with the nobles and the officials, do I respond with a prayerful and a praiseful heart? And then, am I obedient? It's food for thought for me and for all of us, perhaps. As we reflect on these questions, let's look at the final section of our passage and the example that we see within it. Although these verses are primarily about the example that Nehemiah sets during his whole time as governor of Judah, we'll start by looking at the short sentence. It's almost a throwaway line at the end of verse 13, which tells us about the example of his people. It says, the people did as they had promised. They backed up their actions with words. They backed up their words with actions. This seems almost ridiculous in its simplicity, and we might be tempted to think, well, of course, so they should back up what they say by what they do. But how much better a place would the world be if we as Christians really did that? I mean, really did that. For a start, it would help us avoid the reproach from others of being hypocritical. The Tony Campolo quotation is a shocking one, but this one from Brennan Manning is perhaps equally challenging. The greatest cause of atheism in the world today is Christians who acknowledge Jesus with their lips, but then walk out the door and deny him by their lifestyle. That is what an unbelieving world simply finds unbelievable. Is that me? Is that you sometimes? These quotations are not in any way intended to condemn, but they should make us stop and think. I believe we need to be healthily self-critical. Do our actions, our attitudes match up with what we say we believe? Well, back to Nehemiah. What can we learn from his example in this regard? Firstly, he set an example of integrity. As he explains in verses 14 to 16, in all his time as governor of Judea, he neither claimed the food allowance he was entitled to, nor did he seek to acquire any land. In other words, he did not use his position for his own privilege, as it seems his predecessors had done. But instead, he paid his way and he worked alongside his people rather than lording it over them. Secondly, he set an example of wholehearted commitment. Verse 16 tells us that he devoted himself to the rebuilding project. He devoted himself to kingdom work. He truly was a man investing in eternity. A phrase that may resound for some of you guys who were at our curry night a few weeks back. Nehemiah mobilized his men to the cause, and he worked on the wall himself. He led by example as well as by vision, organization, and inspiration. Thirdly, he set an example of hospitality and generosity. Verses 17 to 19 tell us he provided for 150 Jews and officials as well as those from surrounding nations. And it seems that the meat and wine that he provided at his own expense was certainly pretty plentiful. He knew how to throw a party. He was hospitable to others despite all the hostility and opposition that he'd had to deal with. He backed his beliefs with his own wallet. And as we know, there is little more that reflects our hearts than what we do with our wallets. In summary, Nehemiah sets an example to all those around him by being honest, by being generous, and by living life alongside those he leads in wholehearted service. In short, he gets out there and he does it. A man of prayer, yes. A man of words, yes. But most certainly a man of action. The walls of Jerusalem will not build themselves. So what about us? What about our example? Well, Jesus declares that he will build his church and that the gates of hell will not stand against it. But omnipotent though he is, he chooses not to build his kingdom by himself, but amazingly to use not only people like Nehemiah, but people like us who are willing to join him and to do it. I believe we have pastors of this church who mirror this example and who do it. And I'm grateful to God for them. And I was also massively encouraged to read in the Miller Family News this week, our link missionaries in Spain, that Joel, 17 now, who sometimes found it tough finding friends and the acceptance of his peers, has been given a special award at his graduation by his fellow classmates for being an exceptional classmate, person, and friend. One of his teachers commented, apparently, that he was the guy who over the past 3 years had held the class together. And that is a wonderful witness and an example of a young man who really is doing it, who acknowledges Jesus with his lips and then walks out the door and then backs it up by his lifestyle. And that is what an unbelieving world might just find believable. And I also believe we have a great number within this congregation who are living this out in their everyday lives. Jacob has been doing this during his time at university and is about to continue to do so as he embarks upon the Relay program. Those involved in the Hope for Justice group are another really good example of this, and it would be great if we can support them. And there are many others amongst us too. So as we come to a close, how can we summarize what we've seen today in Nehemiah chapter 5? Well, we've seen that kingdom building must be built on principles of justice. We've seen that when the world cries out against injustice, we need to listen to it and listen actively so that we hear it. We've seen that as we do this with God-softened hearts, we will feel the need for justice and should be stimulated to respond. And we've seen that not only our leaders, but also each one of us are called to be an example and to get out there and to do it. So what could you do? What could we do? Let's not gloss over this question. God's been challenging me, and I believe challenges each one of us with it. No one is too young, too old, too busy, of too little influence to do something, to help build God's kingdom, to help act for justice. Remember how Nehemiah started out, a servant in the court of a foreign king. He was a man of little power in himself, but God used him to be a man of great influence. As in the passage, there are people in our world, both at home and abroad, who are in need of food, in need of finances, in need of family. Could you buy a sandwich or a cup of tea for a homeless man in the shop doorway? Or do you need to examine and perhaps change your consumer habits? Cheap products may seem attractive, but they do come to us sometimes at a human cost. Could you buy more fair trade clothes or food? Could you make a donation to those who are running for Hope for Justice today? Could you help support Jacob in his relay program next year as he seeks to build God's kingdom? Could you make a special one-off gift to the church's fellowship fund to help somebody who is in a particular need? Or could you take that real step of faith and help meet the $25,000 faith-giving commitment in the church budget that we voted on a few months ago? Could you get better informed about the challenging issues surrounding modern-day slavery? Speak to Ellie Keevil. Go to the conference that LICC are putting on the 21st of June. It was in a previous bulletin. See me if you'd like details of that. Or could you stand alongside a family in need and sponsor a child in the developing world, offering them hope and a more secure future? I believe that this is about both small acts and lifestyle commitments, but it's not just about social action. It's about heart action. It's not just about giving money. It's about giving life. Jesus ministered to people's spiritual hunger and needs as well as their physical ones. Peter and John, who we heard about last week when Suresh preached, had no silver or gold to give the lame beggar. But what they did have was the power of healing in Jesus' name. And that is what they shared. We don't have to be someone in a position of financial privilege. We just have to realize that we are people who have received the privilege of grace. And the freedom that that brings is something that we can all share. The examples of possible action that I've given are by definition limited. There won't be something there for everyone. But I do believe that God does have something for everyone. Not just to pray about. That's the start, of course, as we see with Nehemiah. But to do something about, to act for justice, to build God's kingdom. We can't ignore this imperative in Nehemiah. We can't leave here today and let our Monday tomorrow be the same as our Monday last week, can we? Because if we do, why are we here? To conclude, I'm just going to read again the initial verse from Micah that I shared at the start. And then I'll encourage us not to pray out loud, but just to be quiet and to offer our hearts to God and to ask him to speak to us, to challenge us and to tell us how he wants each of us to respond. After a minute or so, we're then going to listen to the song, God of Justice. The video images will come up on the screen as well, challenging as they are, and that will serve as our final song, so to speak. We're not going to sing collectively at the end. We're just going to watch and listen rather than sing together. After the blessing, if you have children in the groups, please go and collect them promptly. If you'd like someone to pray with you at the end of the service, I'd be very happy to do that, or else make your way to the back and people will come and pray with you. But let's just be still. Let's listen to the Lord. Let's be ready to hear what he tells us. And let's go from here and let's do it. Let's just close our eyes for a moment. Micah 6, verse 8. What does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. Lord, what does that mean for me? Lord, what does that mean for us? To close, a benediction from St. Francis of Assisi. May God bless you with discomfort at easy answers, half-truths and superficial relationships, so that you may live deep within your heart. May God bless you with anger at injustice, oppression and exploitation of people, so that you may work for justice, for freedom, and for peace. May God bless you with tears to shed for those who suffer from pain, rejection, starvation, and war, so that you may reach out your hand to comfort them and to turn their pain into joy. And may God bless you with enough foolishness to believe that you can make a difference in this world, so that you can do what others claim cannot be done. And the blessing of God, who creates, redeems, and sanctifies, be upon you and all you love and pray for this day and forevermore. Amen. God bless you.